This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello, welcome to episode 8 of
Mixtape Memories. So this is our emo episode.
Yes, we know you've been waiting for this one.
I feel like we couldn't really leave it out because, you know, it was kind of such a big thing in the early 2000s. And when we were either thinking about starting blogs or started ours or started to go regularly to see shows, this was a big movement, yeah. You know? And I feel like a lot of it kind of still lives on today in a more watered down commercial kind of way.
When did you, like, what were your memories of first listening to?
To the whole emo thing? For me, once again, it goes back to college, but I would say around 2000, 2001, maybe until 2002, I was into it. And I would see shows, as usual, in D.C. at 930 Club and Black Hat, which were the two venues back then before they expanded. But yeah, I would go see Dashboard Confessional and Saves the Day and The Anniversary and Ben Queller. Oh, goodness. Take Back Sunday.
Was Ben Queller considered emo? I didn't know that.
You know, I don't know if he necessarily would fall into that, but I do feel like he toured with a lot of emo acts. So I kind of put him in the same kind of bubble, but he's a little outside of it probably.
Like what's the differentiation between like singer-songwriter versus emo?
It's one of those things I feel like for so long people have been trying to exactly put the definition on emo, mm-hmm. and it has changed through the years, I feel. But for me, my definition of it from the early 2000s was just kind of this music that was coming out that was very honest and raw and not overproduced and evoked something in you that was very sincere.
Yeah.
Like I remember in the early days when I would go see Dashboard and everybody would be singing along to the point, probably still happens now. I haven't seen him in 15, 20 years, whatever it's been. Everyone is singing along like at the fullest volume and they're really releasing something. Mm. And I think for me, that's what that stuff was. And I think for me, it might've been timely because I was in college and figuring stuff out and I don't know, Bush was just elected, you know? So like there was a lot to be, I don't know, either angry or emotive about.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, you definitely like get that feeling from the, it's like it is kind of that more kind of sensitive, kind of vulnerable essence to all these songs from the lyrics to like Dashboard. I just realized was like that first album was like just him and his guitar.
Mm-hmm. The first couple, yeah.
That's very unusual, I think, unless you're kind of just saying you're a singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
I think at the time I was confused whether he was, like, just a singer-songwriter or, like, a band.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't that many artists that were going by, like, a band name, but it was mostly just them.
Yeah. I haven't seen him in a long time, but I think back in the day, he would do half the set with just him and an acoustic guitar and half the set with a full band. I want to say these days it's probably a little more band-oriented, but I don't know.
Right, yeah. Who are your favorites of the ones in college?
From that time period, one band I loved and was fortunate enough to see at CBGB's just before it closed was Thursday, okay. which was another subgenre in emo, Screamo.
Oh.
Yeah. And they actually just reunited, and everyone is, and doing like reunion tours and, and touring the first couple albums that did so well. But I was super into them. I actually saw them on a festival that The Cure put together on Randall's Island many, many years ago called Curiosa. Yeah. That had a good bill. That was Mogwai, The Cure, Melissa Auf-der-Maur from Hole, Thursday. Oh God, who else was on that bill? It was a strong bill.
Wait, The Cure curated yes. that?
It was a one-off, one-year-only thing. Yeah.
See, okay. Yeah, well, I don't know that much about Thursday, honestly. Mm-hmm. Although, like, I've definitely, I feel like I've listened to him and, like, not into that, but mm-hmm. Surprises me that, like a Robert Smith or whoever would pick that to be, like, at their festival. Is that weird?
Part of me says yes, and part of me says no, only because I feel like maybe what brings the two together would be just the, laying all the emotions on the table with their lyrics, even though it's so wildly different from each other.
Mm.
Actually, Interpol was on that bill also. Going back to our previous episode.
Yeah, I mean, I could see The Cure, like, being cool with Interpol.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's got that dark, cool yeah. vibe. That's yeah. kind of that mystery
yeah,
that
yeah.
The Cure has. But yeah, no, it's kind of interesting to like hear that, mm-hmm. though. That's cool.
I was into that. But I think one of the bands I was really into, which it's kind of funny. I feel like, you know, we were doing a little research before this episode and there were so few women fronted acts that were in the emo genre. And one of my favorites and actually one of the very, very few that I'll ever revisit from this bulk of this time period is Rainer Maria.
Yeah.
Who we saw together a few months ago yeah, at Elsewhere.
That's right.
And I hadn't seen them in 15 years. So it was actually, speaking of emo, it was an emotional thing for me because I was so drawn to their first couple releases. I saw them all the time at the Black Cat in DC.
Mm.
And I don't know why. I think in general, I've always been drawn to women vocalists. But I think the combination of I don't know, the lyrics and also just everything else. I was a huge Rainer Maria fan. And I can't think of any other... I really can't think of any other female-fronted acts from that time that really stood out. I don't know. It's a weird thing. It was very, like, bro-y in retrospect.
Yeah, yeah. I mean... Yeah, I was reading some articles and a lot of people call it, like, a very, like, boys club
yeah.
kind of genre. But... Yeah, I mean, why is it just that it's more remarkable when a man is vulnerable and sensitive in his lyrics?
I wonder.
Like, you know, even Rainer Maria, like, you listen to them, they don't, like, really sound like your stereotypical kind of emo band. But is it because it's from a girl's perspective or a woman's perspective?
Yeah, perhaps.
For me, just, you know, looking back, like, the, you know, the memory that I have is that it's just a very kind of almost whiny kind of genre.
Well, oh yeah, there was plenty that was whiny.
But when I listen to Rainer Maria, like, I don't feel like it's whiny,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, like, somehow they, or maybe they're just classified as emo because there aren't enough women. So they're just like, well, they were around the same time.
I think also a lot of stuff fell into that umbrella because it was the convenient umbrella at the time. Including some acts that wound up getting some mainstream success that I think actually were the least interesting bands of the time, such as Jimmy Eat World and a few years later, Paramore and, mm-hmm. Oh goodness, who else? That whole Warped Tour kind of environment.
Yeah.
I don't know. Most of those bands were just ridiculous to me.
Yeah, like, for me, it's like Warped Tour was almost, like, became synonymous. It wasn't always, like, in the beginning, I don't think, but, like, eventually became synonymous with this, like, awful emo. Like,
yeah.
That kind of born out of, like, they were probably, like, people who grew up listening to this, and then somehow they took it and, like, they turned it into this, like, I don't know, like, way more awful version of it.
Yeah.
That became, like, wildly popular.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting when you go backwards in time, because I feel like, for me, the unofficial start of emo was bands like Fugazi and the Discord label and all that kind of stuff that was punk-inspired, maybe. And then it kind of led its way into emo. And then... kind of became like mall punk and Warped Tour and
mall punk, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
And just like super stuff that's super uninteresting and painful, honestly. I think Paramore is so big that I saw someone on Instagram, who I unfollowed, by the way, went to like a Paramore cruise. They had like their own boat that they, like, you could buy.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
No. Trapped.
Oh, my God.
You're trapped. No, I mean, like, just imagining the audience for that, like, I just couldn't imagine at all. Like,
I think in general, I don't want to be trapped on a cruise.
Like, no.
Even if it's a band I would love, the thought of not being able to escape. I used to go on a lot of cruises with my family when I was a teenager, and I haven't gone with them in a long time, but my parents love going.
Yeah.
They go all the time now, multiple times a year. That's their thing. They don't fly anywhere. They love going on a cruise. I just don't like that feeling of like,
Yeah. Well, there's not much to do, right? Except the entertainment that they provide. So if you're not into any of that, then you're, you know, SOL.
Yeah, so, exactly.
But
there are other bands I feel like have done that too. I want to say Weezer was part of something like that too.
I think they did have a cruise.
Yeah.
There was like a Weezer cruise. There was a cruise phase.
Yeah, that was a thing.
You know, I never went on like a cruise, but I would go on those like boat shows. Rocks Off. That's
Rocks Off. Yeah. They would go around the city. You'd see two or three bands. You'd have some drinks. And it was actually great because the views were great. You get to see your favorite band. You get to talk to them afterwards. And you don't feel super trapped because it's only about a 3-hour excursion.
Yeah. And it's kind of cool because it's New York and you get to like basically just float around the city.
Yeah.
And see it from like a different, you know, more, you know, romanticized perspective. So that was fun. But yeah, I would often feel kind of seasick. And those boats were not very big.
No.
So like, if it was like, for instance, like a sold out show or something, you know. And I remember like there were tons of booze cruises. They call them booze cruises. So it'd be like, you buy into like some kind of, and then just be drinking unlimited amounts of booze. That never seemed like a very smart idea, but a very kind of fun idea. But like,
I don't think it's a good combo with the a shaky boat.
Yes.
Because you're just, it makes you feel really ill.
Yeah, yeah, like if you don't have like some kind of sea legs or like some kind of, you know, not anti-nausea pill or something.
My mom always wears the stuff that goes on your wrist that supposedly, I don't know, helps keep you at a certain level so you don't feel the waves and everything.
Okay.
But
she's,
I don't know.
She's a pro cruiser.
She's a pro. Yeah. She's a super pro.
Yeah.
But that's not my bag. So anyway, going back to, you know, bands being on cruises, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, it's a pricey venture. I mean, even if it's just a long weekend, there's no way you're going to be able to go for under a few hundred dollars plus, in a lot of cases, the airfare of getting there. So if your favorite band is doing something, you know, from Key West, Florida to somewhere in the Caribbean and then back, you're going to have to pay for the airfare there plus that and then entertain yourself for the other 70 hours that the band is not playing.
Yeah.
And do shuffleboard or overeat or whatever, you know. I don't think so.
No, no. Not really my bag.
No.
So there's no artist. Are you saying there's no artist you would go on a cruise for?
Oh, God. I'd really have to think. You know, there's one artist I love who, I mean, she's not really a musician, but someone I love, a burlesque performer, Dita Von Teese, I love.
Oh, yeah.
And she was part of a cruise recently, and I thought about going for a minute, but it was like all EDM acts, and then she was doing a couple, like one night of burlesque. So I was thinking to myself, for 1 or 2 hours of her doing shows, it's not worth it all
that
in
seems
all.
Like a strange combination, EDM
she's
and
very,
Dita.
She's very into the, like, she kind of got her start in the early 90s rave scene. So she's very into, like, early Chemical Brothers and Basement Jacks and, like,
I had no idea. Because
Orbital
I always think,
and all that
didn't
stuff.
Didn't she, like, date Marilyn Manson?
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, I always think, just assume maybe she was more, like, goth. Or...
She actually was more, like ecstasy culture early 90s.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah, which is kind of funny.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And she was at the time, and the last thing I'll say about her is that she was like the only one who was like bringing back that old like Betty Page kind of thing and dark hair, because at the time the early 90s LA thing was like the blonde haired blue-eyed Baywatch Pamela Anderson type thing. And she was like, I'm actually going in this direction,
right? I mean, that's cool.
Yeah.
Like
and that. Then she kind of made a career out of it. And then, of course, when she married Marilyn Manson, it kind of raised her profile significantly. But yeah, I adore her. But even so, I wouldn't go on a cruise for her. So I would, if I wouldn't go on a cruise for Dita, I'm definitely not going on one for Paramore or Weezer.
Yeah, no, definitely not Weezer.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, yeah, emo's not my genre, but mm-hmm. what I do remember from, like, 90s mixtapes, I actually liked Sunny Day Real Estate.
Yeah.
And there was just something about, maybe it's because they were, like, a little bit fuzzier mm-hmm. in their sound and a little bit warmer, and there's something about the way the music and the vocals sounded on their songs that I was, like, into, probably, like, you know, leading off my shoegaze kind of love.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't seem as, like, sometimes I think emo songs can sound, like, kind of a little bit annoying. So, mm-hmm. like, they didn't annoy me. I actually enjoyed them on the mixtapes, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't have even known that they were, like, called emo.
Yeah, yeah.
No, just looking over like this list of, you know, bands we've kind of accumulated, you know, qualified as emo supposedly. At the drive-in, I really like the
maybe it's the only At the Drive-In album, but the breakthrough one at the very least.
They broke up after that. Yeah, I think.
I actually really like that album, but that also is a very angry kind of album.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not as it's more aggressive than your emo. So
yeah,
what would that be?
I wouldn't say that they were screamo. I don't know what I would classify them as.
They're in between. They're kind of
yeah,
hemo. obviously they grew very popular with their song "One Arm Scissor."
Of course, yeah.
I even like. Remember seeing them on like one of those late shows. It might have been like Conan or mm-hmm, something. Mm-hmm. And being like, this is insane that they're on there. Mm-hmm. But they were born out of, wasn't it like members of Mars Volta or something like that?
Mars Volta came after.
Oh, Mars Volta came after.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wasn't into that.
No, I wasn't into that either.
It seemed like
that was more like proggy. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, it was.
But At the Drive-In, I dug. I never saw them back in the day, which I regret. I know I talked about Death Cab at a certain point earlier this season, but I was really into their first couple albums, and they were put out through Barsook Records, which I feel like was putting out some of the more softer emo stuff.
That's true.
Yeah.
Barsook. I almost forgot about them.
Yeah. They had a couple bands I was into.
They were always into that kind of sensitive indie sound.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I feel like that's something different though. Like the sensitive indie rap
that's
versus
true.
Like emo.
That probably was its own subgenre that I don't know.
Yeah.
I also really liked The Promise Ring back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, they have a song called Make Me a Mixtape, which I feel like if we had the rights, we should play now, but you know. And then who else? The Anniversary I was really into. They were kind of a little more spastic and strange. But they had a moment where they were actually like one of the leading, quote unquote, you know, emo acts of the time in like 102.
Like respected.
Yeah.
You know, not like kind of cartoonish, but like actual respect there.
They were cool. But yeah, I mean, I remember this is probably around the time when I would go see something just because, you know, Chris from Dashboard Confessional was a fan of the band. So I wanted to check them out because it was like the emo band du jour, you know. Right.
You know, we played this earlier. I won't play it on the podcast, but I did interview him back in, it must have been like around when his album came out. Yeah, I was working at this like teen website. What was the name of that album? The Places
You've Come to Fear the Most.
Yes. That just came out and I think he was touring it. You could just tell like he was like super not into doing the interview, and I had to ask some like ridiculous questions because I was like working for a teen website. And you never ask real questions.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to know that. You know, at the time at least, maybe it's different now. I just felt like he took himself really seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely sound like I'm not that into his record, although I just keep asking him question after question.
You were very prepared.
I was very prepared, but he was like not into.
But I feel like if he were told in advance the nature of the interview, then he wouldn't be so thrown off by questions about what's your sign, or tell me about your tattoos, explain those. Like,
do you have a girlfriend?
Yeah, yeah, those are the kind of questions that are going to be in a teen publication, you know?
Yeah, like, they should have prepared him a little bit more. Back then, you know, you probably just said yes to every interview.
Yeah, I guess so.
You know,
he probably just did a whole round all day.
He didn't know. Like, I probably wouldn't know what that website was back then if I didn't work there, you know?
Right. He was an interesting one because I feel like he was the heartthrob / poster boy of the whole movement.
Yeah.
And that also maybe had its own level of,
yeah,
I don't know, weirdness.
I mean, you kind of have to have good looks in order to kind of be successful in that genre, because it's like, you're, you know, most of your fans are going to be women.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, and like, so your following is going to be like women, counting on women liking you for that. Although, I guess today you could be Ed Sheeran.
Oh, goodness. I have many thoughts on Ed Sheeran.
Still be very popular, but maybe not the best looking guy.
No,
right?
No.
So, but, you know, back then I just feel like, you know, people were more superficial. I mean, it was the days of Britney and Justin.
That's,
you know,
true.
So it was like boy band central, and like, but even not even like boy band people were like good looking.
Yeah. Well, if you really think about that time around 2000, 2001, 2002, it was obviously all the pop that you just mentioned that was so wildly huge.
Yeah.
For the first time in a bit. And then it was kind of the tail end of that whole terrible nu metal thing.
Oh, God.
Thank God. With Limp Bizkit and Linkin Park and all the rest of them.
Yeah. I remember interviewing like Hoobastank.
Oh, my God.
I still have that tape. And yeah, just like
there was a lot of terrible music right around
so
the millennium.
Much awful.
Yeah,
so much awful.
And then this was going on, and then I feel like a few years later, indie culture and kind of a response to this in some way maybe kind of took off. But there was a lot of stuff that, I mean, it
but
just
back
wasn't
then it
good.
Wasn't being covered, and that's why like blogs started, and that's why like sites like Pitchfork started and tried to have a little bit of balance and be more, and it was like about people being in tune more with like the local music culture than like the national music culture.
Yes.
Where once you go national, it kind of is like dumbs down to the common denominator kind of music, where it's like, you know, the quality is like kind of sacrificed for like more poppiness and like the ability to reach masses versus just a niche. Who are the people that are covering the small bands still
these days?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I feel like I might have mentioned this earlier in an earlier episode, but yeah, it's a small pool, especially for acts that are you know, not already established or already affiliated with a bigger label, or you know, have an in somewhere. It's depressing actually, because just the entire landscape was so different. You know, I feel like every few years it changes dramatically, but if you look at the landscape in 04, 09, 14, 5, 10, 15 years ago, every chunk of time it's dwindled in terms of outlets that cover that stuff. You know?
I think like Brooklyn Vegan
kind
of still has balanced coverage.
Yeah.
Probably due to Bill Paris.
Yeah, who's great.
You know, because he's still going to shows, I think. And, you know, still kind of in tune with that kind of underground
scene. Very much
so. You know, obviously has like a certain specific taste.
Mm-hmm. And that site still has, I mean, it's wildly successful, but also has an independent element to it.
Yeah. Even though I don't think it's independent, right?
I don't know exactly what's going on with them in terms of like their business.
Oh, yeah.
But,
me neither.
Yeah. They might be affiliated with something larger, but it doesn't feel that way at least.
Yeah.
You know,
still kind
it's
of
not
operating.
Like everything is mega branded and stuff. It doesn't feel that
Maybe
way.
Maybe it's not actually, because when I've done ads with Brooklyn Vegan and I've corresponded with Dave directly.
Yeah,
like if it was bigger, then he probably wouldn't be still doing the
that's
ads.
True, that's true.
The ad sales.
Yeah, that's true.
But it just, and but you know, like And yeah, like they would probably have more than one staff writer, said Bill Paris. Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, I think they have a couple others now, but yeah, it's still a very small group.
I guess it's surprising. And, you know, if he is still independent, maybe like kudos to Dave.
Yes. Well, I think regardless if he is or isn't, like the site has been, you know, going strong for so long, while other blogs have died and are, you know.
Yeah. And kind of lost their like initial integrity.
Yeah.
You know.
So kudos to Brooklyn Vegan for keeping it going. And yeah, it's exciting.
Yay, go BV.
So one of our repeat skips is going to be kind of a quintessential album from that time frame. And he's still kicking and doing stuff is Bright Eyes / Conor Oberst and the Lifted album, which was kind of a breakthrough.
Yeah, this is kind of, I feel like... when I first heard about Bright Eyes, it was kind of fascinating to me because that first single off of the Lifted album, Lover I Don't Have to Love, which mm-hmm. is my repeat. Mm-hmm. But it had kind of like a dancey, I don't know, like a more upbeat kind mm-hmm. of vibe to it. And mm-hmm. it wasn't like the kind of stereotypical, I don't know.
I love that song too. Yeah, and I do feel like it doesn't necessarily fall into the emo bubble. But yeah, he was really, I think also he benefited from being good looking. But also he also bared his soul on these songs and a lot of people related. And, you know, he's done some interesting things with his career over the last 15 or so years. But... you know, he brought a lot of light to Saddle Creek Records, mm-hmm. Which, you know, I believe his brother was at some point involved with.
His brother's like helped finance his like music career and like I'm paying for like album production. And then I think that they're still maybe involved in Saddle Creek just as like, you know, on a higher level. But yeah, like I think they started, or at least one of his brothers started it kind of really blew up the whole Omaha
yeah scene. Exactly.
I mean, who thought of Omaha but like as like a scene, but there was a definite scene there.
And you know, Saddle Creek is home to a friend of mine and one of my favorite acts to this day, the Minor Birds. So it's Laura Burren, who was in Georgie James with Q and Not You, going back to emo land and DC circles in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And I adore her, and she's criminally underrated, but she's on Saddle Creek and she's released all of her albums through Saddle Creek. But I also agree with you. I think Lover I Don't Have to Love is probably one of the stronger tracks. I also like the other single from the album, Bowl of Oranges. Mm-hmm. But I do think there are moments on this album where Conor Oberst kind of goes all over the place, or he's kind of like talking and not singing, mm-hmm. or there's like a lot of random stuff going on. And for me, probably one of the ones I would skip is Let's Not Shit Ourselves. But honestly, looking back on this album, there are only a handful of tracks that I think are quality, mm-hmm. and the other, there's quite a few that I would throw away, honestly. I feel like perhaps later on, he released an album that had Emmy Lou Harris on it a couple years later.
Yeah.
It's a really pretty album. He's done some stuff through the years that I think is noteworthy, but I don't see Conor / Bright Eyes as a album artist personally. I think he has moments.
Right.
And I think that also holds true for me with this album. There are just a few key moments.
Was like Bright Eyes the band, or was it kind of like Dashboard where it was like a...
I mean, I never really knew the answer to that, but I think Bright Eyes was his pseudonym.
Yeah.
But whenever I saw Conor, it was always with a band. So maybe Bright Eyes was the band. Mm-hmm. But I think it originally was his way of not identifying as himself.
Yeah.
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 And then it kind of took its own...
But then, you know, like people just really called, you know, it was like interchangeable mm-hmm. all the time, Conor or Bright Eyes.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's what's interesting is he released albums as Bright Eyes, then as Conor, then as Bright Eyes.
Yeah. Then he had Desaparecidos.
Oh, right? Was that early on? I don't.
I think it was kind of it was either concurrent or like right after Bright Eyes.
Okay.
Kind of got big. Then it had like this offshoot that maybe they already existed or something, but was getting attention because he was getting attention.
Got it. Okay.
And they were a little bit more metal-y in their sound.
I vaguely recall this. Yeah.
And, but yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know that I could really pick a skip because I think I only liked that one song. So
yeah, I think most of this is kind of skippable, honestly, in retrospect. But at the time I was really into it. And I think with a lot of these albums that we repeat and skip, they had meaning to us at some point. But as we get older and as we revisit them, like when we looked back on Green Day's Dookie, it was mostly unlistenable. Yeah. But at the time it was very exciting for me in 1994.
Yeah.
And this one too, in like, whatever it was, a 102, you know.
I think it's because like our feelings have matured, so like we don't feel that way anymore. Like things are so, when you're younger things feel so much more you know, it doesn't matter what it is,
yeah,
it just feels so much more like tremendous and like big and like the but then you get older and you look back and you're like, why was I so melodramatic? Like,
exactly.
Why did I have all those emotions?
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Like, so they don't necessarily stand up to the test of time, but maybe if someone covered it in a different way. But, you know, as they were recorded, I don't know that it really kind of, at least like I can't really relate to it as much. But yeah, like I guess the other album, you know, we already talked about Dashboard Confessional, but The Places You've Come to Fear the Most, you know.
This was his breakthrough moment because I feel like Screaming Infidelities was on MTV or at least MTV2 at the time, all the time.
Yeah.
And then, slowly but surely he became, like I was saying earlier, like the face of it all.
Yeah.
And he had those,
and
know,
the look,
the, and the look, yeah. The look, the gelled hair. Yeah.
You know, he's just so serious.
Yeah.
I think that's like the other thing is like these artists, they don't necessarily have like a sense of humor.
Yeah.
About themselves or their music. They're just, everything is so full on, like they're feeling it. And this album, I think maybe it was like quintessential emo album, I guess, but I just didn't think that much really stood the test of time. I mean, like, I re-listened to Screaming Infidelities, and...
Speaking of another artist and album with terrible lyrics.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, even in the chorus, your hair is everywhere.
Your hair is everywhere. Screaming Infidelities.
Oh, my God.
You know, like, it was a bit much, I think. That's just how I feel. Like that, I didn't like that Screaming Infidelity song, This Bitter Pill. I thought it was a little bit much. I wouldn't want to listen to that.
Yeah.
But it was hard for me to pick one that I liked, actually. Because I just don't think, like, my mind, like, I'm just not in that mindset. I don't know if I ever was with Dashboard. You know, I think I just recognized that they were, like, you know, bringing up this genre.
For me, I think a lot of this is just, it's kind of laughable actually when I look back and think back to a time when I would go to every local Dashboard show in a 2 or 3 year span and sing along and try and be in the front. And I remember meeting him once and I was super excited and nervous, but now it's like, oh my God. I actually saw he was doing a run of shows, or they, I should say, couple months back, and he was doing the whole thing also where it's like pay extra for the meet and greet and go to the sound check, and I'm like, this would be hilarious, but no,
you know? Wow.
Yeah, but for a couple hundred dollars you could do that as well.
Yeah,
but like I was saying,
I wonder what his crowd is like now. Is it all the people like also,
that's a good question,
or is it like a new kind of younger crowd still?
I wonder. I really wonder, because at the time in the early 2000s it was a very young crowd. Everyone was pretty much high school, college aged. And I don't know if people have grown with his music necessarily.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like,
because I think a lot of people, I would assume, are in the same boat I am, where it's kind of just not something I'm into anymore.
Yeah, you know, like I know I liked it, but it just doesn't feel that way.
Yeah,
you know, but you know, he's an artist, and I respect him as an artist, but I just don't relate to it
no
anymore.
I do recall one of the songs I would sing along to at the top of my lungs when I would see him was The Best Deceptions mm-hmm. on this album. I feel like a lot of these songs on the album, and when we were re-listening to it, we kind of sensed this also. Like, they have such, it's so formulaic because it starts off kind of pretty and he's setting the tone, and then it goes into like the either the screamy chorus or the screamy, I don't know.
Yeah.
Post whatever.
Like every song.
Yeah, every single song.
We were trying to find one that didn't.
Yeah. I guess at the time I didn't realize it, like it was, you know. Yeah. But that's the way he built up the track yeah. all the time.
And I think that maybe, I don't know, like were other artists before him kind of like that too? Or did he really kind of launch this like weird formula into like.
I don't know if he originated it, but I always associate it with him.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's still going. So, you know, there are people out there that are listening. And like I was saying earlier, he did a stadium tour like a few years back. So,
yeah, that's a long career.
Yeah, that's a long career. But I do not know who the fan base is now. I'd be very interested to look.
I know.
I should look at like his Facebook group and just kind of see who the people are, like just that's by true. Their faces, that's you know.
See who's posting on his wall.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All right. So that was our emo episode, episode 8.
I don't even know what to say. It was a journey.
It was a journey. Stay tuned for episode 9. And thanks again for listening to Mixtape Memories. We'll see you next time.
See you next time. Bye.
Bye.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.